How do you go from respected history of science scholar to best-selling author? Well, if you're Deborah Harkness, you make one of your leading characters a science historian, and then you add vampires. Harkness's All Souls trilogy was a huge hit. The third and final novel, The Book of Life, is out in paperback this week. Now, the series began in 2011, where we meet the trilogy's main character, Diana Bishop. She's a witch and a professor. She discovers a mysterious manuscript, which promptly vanishes, so Bishop sets out to look for it with the help of Matthew Claremont, scientist and 1,500-year-old vampire. We spoke to Deborah Harkness about The Book of Life last July, and she told us about the inspiration for the series, which was this question: imagine vampires really did exist. What's their job?
As a historian of science, I study how people in the past came up with stories about the world and how it worked and their place in it. And I was traveling in Mexico and went through an airport bookstore, and I suddenly looked up and there was a wall full of books about vampires, witches, demons, shapeshifters, you name it. And I looked at that wall and I thought, if there really are all those creatures, what on earth do they do for a living? I guess the rest is history, as they say.
Yeah, I love that you asked what seems to be such a straightforward and practical question, what do they do for a living? But on the other hand, through your lens as a historian, what people do for a living like really unlocks their histories and their cultures, does it not?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's a huge part of what we do. So being able to really figure out, you know, if you were a vampire and you had a lot of time on your hands, what would you choose to do with that time? And I thought, well, anything that has a long-term return. So I was thinking, you know, investment of money, art connoisseurship, science, all of those things would be great options for somebody who knew that they had centuries.
And in the case of the main vampire in your series, Matthew, not only does he have centuries, I mean, he has millennia. He's, what, 1,500 years old?
Yeah, I'm a historian. There was not going to be any 70-year-old vampires, anything like that. I was going to have a serious vampire.
And he's a scientist, too.
He is a scientist. So, again, as a historian of science, I really very deliberately selected his time of rebirth as a vampire. It was a period in European history where language, literature was not often studied. There were no universities. And so I tried to imagine a kind of trajectory that someone would take who was interested in the same kind of questions I am. You know, how does the world work? What is my place in it? Which are the basic questions of science? And then to follow his development through not just 50 years, but 1,500 years. And it was so much fun.
Suddenly it occurs to me, I mean, your area of expertise is in Elizabethan England. Was there or is there anything about that particular place and time in history that you think really lends itself to these kind of thought experiments, which are so beautifully rendered in your trilogy?
I think it's a period when a lot of the things people thought they knew about the world and how it worked were starting to crumble and crumble pretty rapidly, but there weren't yet great explanations that would replace them. So the Elizabethan England is the period, it's right on the heels of the Copernican Revolution. Mm-hmm. So the universe had literally just been reorganized and turned inside out. There was attempts made to reform the calendar. 10 whole days were stripped out of a year because the astronomical data and the calendar making had gotten out of sync at a time. People were just beginning to develop trigonometry, and calculus would come in another sort of 60 years. But really, it's another 100 years until Newton. So the medieval worldview is crumbling. The modern worldview is not yet in place. And so it was in a time of enormous possibility and play when magic and science really were very equal players on the stage in terms of what will give us answers. And that's what really fascinates me, because we think of magic and science as being quite diametrically opposed. In the period that I study, they're actually quite close together.
Interesting. Well, let's talk about Diana. She's the central character in the trilogy. She's a witch, but has this very complicated relationship with her own power. And much of her journey through these three books basically is her coming to terms with this supernatural prowess that she has. Why did you decide to approach her character in that way?
Being a witch has not ever really been a great thing in culture, whether Eastern, Western, ancient, medieval, modern, being labeled a witch is problematic for women. And yet, most popular literature today makes it into something that is unproblematic, that should be eagerly embraced, that you can just sort of accept with eagerness and gusto. You are magically blessed. You got your ticket to Hogwarts and off you go. And I really wanted to explore why someone might not want that kind of a legacy. And in part, it was inspired by my teaching. I see enormously talented women in my classes, women who are brilliant, who have so much to offer for the world, and who are, in a way, kind of desperately trying to hide that because they don't want to stand out too much. And so I really wanted to write a story of a woman who grew into her power and came to accept her power and didn't just sort of, you know, take it up and start casually wielding thunderbolts in every direction, like without a care in the world, because that just doesn't seem to me to reflect what I see when I walk into my classroom.
Yeah.
And I really wanted to explore that a bit more.
I think that's one of the reasons why so many people have loved your book so much, because through these characters, they present the perfect vehicle to really talk about the duality of individual and cultural struggles. I mean, we see that in so many ways, even in Matthew, because, of course, he's very dashing.
Absolutely.
He's rich and he's handsome. He's a little overprotective.
He has an anger management
problem. Yeah, I mean, he at the same time, he's, to put it bluntly, he's a killer.
Yeah, he is a killer. And he tells her that right up front. And a lot of what happens between Diane and Matthew as a couple, but also what happens to them individually, is that they both have to really face who they are. And I think that really is all of our journeys wrapped up, you know, in a very simple language. We're all learning to accept who we are as people. I think that it does, you know, what I tell my students when I teach these subjects is that witches are monsters to think with. They're a place where we park our cultural anxieties and our issues and we play with them. And the stories we tell are as revealing about who we are as a culture as they are about any of the witches who were supposedly, you know, making up stories about.
Mm. We have to talk about one of the non-mythical creatures, or maybe it is a mythical creature, but this is a non-living one. It's a book at the center of the trilogy, the Ashmole 782, which is a book that Diana finds at the start of the trilogy. It's filled with images of alchemical drawings, such as on a particular page, there's this chemical wedding of gold and silver. Mm-hmm. Now, this is a book that has been rendered out of your imagination, but you actually have had a similar experience in your work as a historian. You found, is it a lost manuscript or two?
I found two copies of the same manuscript. I was looking for something else entirely. It was completely accidental. And I looked in a book I had been looking for actually for years. I suddenly looked at the top of a catalog page at the Bodleian Library in Oxford, and there was a word, Alderaya. And I had been looking for something called Alderaya or the Book of Soyga for 3.5 years when I was writing my dissertation and could not find it. And there it was. The minute I stopped looking for it, it turned up. And it was a book that was owned by Queen Elizabeth I's court astrologer, a man named John Dee. And it was supposed to carry within it, we thought, all of the secrets about why he was so interested in magic and talking with angels through a crystal ball. And of course, when we actually opened it, it didn't contain anything like that at all. But yes, and I should say about Ashmole 782, Ashmole 782 was another book that I called up and wanted to look at the Bodleian Library, and when I put in my request for it, it came back as lost.
Uh-huh.
So Ashmole 782 is a real lost manuscript at the Bodleian Library. I've just imagined what maybe might be in it.
And I love the fact that the initial discovery happened at the Bodleian. I mean, what a perfect place to launch anyone on an adventure. Exactly.
Yeah. As someone who's worked there, if you're going to find a vampire in Oxford, the Bodleian's a good place to look.
Deborah Harkness, congratulations on the end of the trilogy, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a really lovely afternoon. Thanks.